So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed.
Happy Palm Sunday to you. One of my favorite Sundays on the calendar. I think it's because of the way my dad raised me. He always made a big deal out of Palm Sunday. There'd be palm branches all along the pews when we go to church, and me and my brothers would sit in the pews and whack each other with them while he was giving like a really good Sunday sermon. But it was always, you know, I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I should have as a kid, but looking back on it, my dad had a special way of always making Palm Sunday and Good Friday and Easter Sunday very, very special. So I hope you had a special Palm Sunday on this April Fool's Day, which is highly ironic. And tonight we got a great show for you tonight. I've been excited to do the show. I'm excited about our guest, Dr. Stephen Collins from Trinity Southwest University, professor of archaeology there, and just a fascinating guy to talk with. And I'm excited that you could be here, Dr. Collins. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here, yo.
And man, I'm really excited to dive into tonight's topic as we talk about, does it matter if the tomb is empty? Is really what we're going to focus on. And as we go into this Holy Week leading up to Easter, it's a pivotal question. As you remember, last week we came across a statistic that over 50% of Christian teenagers don't believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. So the question is, does it matter? Can you call yourself a Christian if you don't believe Jesus rose from the dead? And a lot of people treat this stuff as fable, as myth. It's a good story to help you feel good and live a good life, but it doesn't really matter if it's historical or not. And tonight we're going to discuss, does it matter if it's historical? Now, Dr. Collins, before we dive into that, why don't you give us a brief update on how things are going with your dig at Sodom and Gomorrah, and how's all that progressing?
Well, I assigned the digging of Gomorrah to another guy.
Okay.
We took the big one. We kind of give the leftovers to the other people. No, it's going really well. We had a great 7-week season from the last part of December to the first week or so of February, and it was dynamite. You know, the previous year, we had said in our reports that since we needed the Middle Bronze Age city, which is the time of Abraham, we had to have that, I mean, to really prove that this was Sodom. And we thought we saw some things that would lead us to that conclusion, that we had a Middle Bronze Age city. Well, this year, we nailed it.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. I mean, we've got pottery and other kinds of artifacts that are specifically dating it to the Middle Bronze Age. We have we discovered actually dug out a huge part of the fortification system. So it had a big city wall, a big city fortification around it. We dug out about 15, 20 feet of it.
Oh,
and
nice.
So it's looking pretty spectacular right now.
Yeah. Cool.
It's, so the critics were kind of taking pot shots at us. They're still trying to shoot at us, of mm-hmm. course. There was a front page story about our dig in the Wall Street Journal about 4 weeks ago. And William Deaver, who's a pretty well-known archaeologist, he was taking pot shots at me. He says, no responsible scholar goes out with a Bible in one hand and a trowel in the other. And you know, I was just going, yeah, right, okay. You know, it's like, how are you going to find any kind? You know, we got dozens of Bible cities all over the Holy Land, right?
Right.
I mean, you can even drive the freeways in Israel, you know, turn left to Jerusalem, right to Beth Shemesh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are all biblical names. How do we know all these cities? Well, because all the archaeologists through history have at least had a Bible in their hip pocket.
Right.
So that's all we did was look at the Bible, go to the place where the Bible says Sodom ought to be. We dug it up. It's there, bigger than life. And now the scholars are having to deal with it. As I said when I came in, I got some Southern Baptist pastor in Tennessee who has this blog, and he's just been blasting me for the last month. He doesn't believe that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is historical.
Man.
You know, this is pretty scary. And neither does the guy believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when you told me that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to me. Yeah. So here you got these people who are pastoring churches, and they're totally denying the historical accuracy of the Bible.
Right.
Now that freaks me out.
And
I just go ballistic. My computer starts smoking when I when I blog these guys. And of course, he won't post my comments. I shoot him comments and he won't post it. Listen, this is an important subject. Here we are in the Easter season once again, and now everybody's coming out against the resurrection. Ah, Jesus really didn't rise from the dead.
Right.
The tomb is empty. How do we know the tomb is empty? That's because a bunch of archaeologists in 1980 emptied Jesus' body and Mary's and everybody. You know, that's that new discovery.
Right.
They took all the bones out and reburied them. Yeah, there's a lot of nonsense floating around right now, but Christianity, you know, let's face it, it relies on the resurrection of Jesus from the dead.
Yeah, that's what it's really all about. You know, as Paul pointed out, if Jesus Christ didn't rise from the dead, then we're pretty pitiful to believe in this whole faith of Christianity.
Yeah, I think his word was stupid or something along that line.
Absolutely. Well, if you have a question or comment about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, does it matter if he historically rose from the dead? Give us a call, 505-338-5790. It's a rare opportunity to get a chance to talk with Dr. Collins about this, and I'm excited about it. So if you have questions, you better jump in, because otherwise I'm going to take up the entire time asking my questions. Now, Dr. Collins, right before we went on the air, we were talking about, you know, the tomb sites, because, you know, one of the things that people always point to is, well, I've been to the tomb, and he's not there. Which, you know, is obviously good evidence for Jesus Christ being risen from the dead. Of course, the question is, which tomb site have you been to? I went to Israel, I think it was 1995, 95, 96, one of those years. And it was a great tour because we had a guide who was very balanced in what he did. He would present a lot of sites. It could be this, it could be that. I'll let you decide. Here's the evidence for this, that, or the other thing. And of course, we saw the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Garden Tomb. Now, most Christians are very enamored with the Garden Tomb, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is what it sounds like. It's a church, which for me was kind of underwhelming, you know, to go to all these sites and find churches built on top of them, because I kind of wanted to see the actual site. And so I think a lot of Christians feel there's a lot more authenticity for the Garden Tomb, because it looks like you would picture it. But as we're talking about this, I thought your take on it was very interesting. I said, which do you think, Garden Tomb or Church of the Holy Sepulchre? And you said,
see, you're going to get me in trouble.
That's why we do the show.
Yeah, I am a Christian, let me say that, you know, and a pretty conservative one at that. But I also think of myself as what I call an empirical factualist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to get weepy about a lot of things. I'm just going to go with the evidence. And frankly, there is zero in favor of the Garden Tomb. Now, a lot of people go to the Garden Tomb. That's where a lot of people have their real emotional experience.
Yep.
And I've had pastors tell me, oh, you know, they just, the Holy Spirit just told them that while they were there, that was the real tomb of Jesus. And, you know, I have a hard time with that. I'll tell you why, just in a nutshell.
Yeah.
The Bible says Jesus was buried in a new tomb, mm-hmm. a newly hewn rock tomb in which no body had been laid up to that point. The tomb of the Garden Tomb is an Iron Age period tomb in which many bodies had laid over the centuries. It doesn't even date to the time of Jesus, so it's a much older Iron Age tomb and just doesn't have any credibility at all. Archaeologically, the tomb that's associated with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which of course is all
gaudied
up and built over with all the Byzantine Church and all of that. You know, if you can stand all the little swinging smoke sensors there and everything.
It's crazy.
But if you just could scrape all of that away and just look at the terrain, it probably has a lot to commend it. Mm-hmm. That site goes back all the way to the 3rd, 4th century as far as the local Christian attestation of where that tomb is located.
Mm-hmm.
The Garden Tomb, you know, we have to go all the way to the 19th century before anybody even thought about it. By the way, the area of the Garden Tomb, most of that whole area, the Golgotha area, even the area of the skull, that was completely under ground and under rock in the time of Jesus. It's all been quarried out in later times. It's a rock quarry.
Right.
But anyway, there's another tomb site that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
It's way up on the Mount of Olives, and it's under what's called the Eleona Church. Now, I got a chance to look at that tomb, photograph that tomb several years ago, and then they came along and built a big wing of the convent over the over the top of it. So
that's
those
clever.
Tombs, those there's a whole bunch of garden tombs up there. It is a garden tomb area and had been a garden tomb area since the first century.
Hmm.
It's not anymore. They built buildings, but I like that one. And but there are many possibilities because
right.
those kinds of tombs are very common around Jerusalem. This is a typical Judean style rolling stone tomb.
Right.
And but I think, you know, Church of the Holy Sepulchre is reasonable.
And, you know, I think it's fun to go to the Garden Tomb because, like I said, at least there you kind of get a sense of maybe what it looked like. You know, when I was there, I did the little stoop in to look in, you know, kind of mm-hmm. like the disciple that Jesus loved did when he first got to the tomb. And that was all fun. And it was fascinating to listen to, you know, the curators of that, you know, talk about, you know, what scriptures they used to defend it and whatnot. But, you know, in my mind, it's like, okay, it could be this. It could be the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The point is, the grave is empty. And that's really important.
No, that was the whole big deal. The reason nobody in the world at that time up to now knew where the tomb was, because after Jesus had risen from the dead, everybody's focused on him being alive.
Right.
And so for the first 3.5-4 centuries of Christianity, the tomb site never became a place of pilgrimage.
Right.
They just didn't talk about it. And it took Constantine's mother, Queen Helena, to come over and ask all these people around, she said, well, where was Jesus buried? And everybody kind of looked at each other and kind of shrugged, and then they kind of, over there! You know, they kind of made up something. And
right.
And then she built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre over it.
And I still think that's such a bummer. I mean, that was one of the fun parts about, you know, being in Israel, but also one of the kind of a bummer parts is there's churches everywhere. Like, every site that would be really interesting just to see all natural. There's some sort of church built over it, and I was kind of bummed at that. But, you know, the churches were very nice, and the structures themselves.
Yeah,
were pretty...
you know those books then and now?
Yeah.
You know, I love those books because they show what the ruin looks like, and then they show what it used to look like.
Right.
Well, we need one that does the opposite.
Yeah,
we need
exactly.
one that shows what's there today, and then you turn back and takes it back, does away with the building, and shows you what the natural terrain looks like.
That would be
like.
Very, yeah. very nice. Now, Dr. Collins, let's kind of establish what kind of criteria do we need to establish something as an actual historical event? You know, before we talk specifically about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, when you are looking at some sort of event, especially of ancient history, as opposed to more recent history when there's more ways to record what went on, but especially with ancient history, what kind of criteria do you need to establish something as fact as opposed to just myth?
Yeah, before TV and video, you have to have eyewitnesses. You have to have people who are actually Johnny on the spot. People who were there saw exactly what happened, or at least can verify at least aspects of it. You know, there are no eyewitnesses to any event who sees every little tiny aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
People have different perspectives. They stand around events and see them from different angles. That's exactly what we have in the New Testament, a whole collection of eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And by the way, a lot of people think those accounts are contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe how many scholars are out there that say, oh, you know, John doesn't agree with Luke, and Luke doesn't exactly agree with Mark, and everybody's kind of disjointed on the way the whole thing went down. Listen, everybody had their own perspective. Everybody stood at a particular place. Everybody had their own interaction with Jesus after the resurrection. Everybody takes it from their own point of view, and what they see gets expanded. That's the big part of it. What everybody else did, what everybody else experienced, really is not a part of their experience, so it becomes kind of a secondary thing to them. And so when different people write about the same kind of event from different angles, we get different stories. And that's as it should be. I mean, you go into a court of law, and if all your witnesses say exactly identically the same thing, like they're reading off a list, we suspect collusion. We suspect something fishy is going on. Mm-hmm. But if they come in just straightforwardly telling what happened without fear of contradiction, without fear of what anybody else said, that's a sign that they're just telling the truth. That's what the gospel writers have done. Little differences in their stories make absolutely – by the way, all those things can be harmonized. You can put all that together in a nice flowing narrative. But the fact that one says, you know, there were three women, the other says there were four, and some two, and listen, it all adds up to four. there are just different aspects of it that have to be taken into consideration. And when we look at it, it's good eyewitness testimony. It's as good as it gets.
Right. And what about historical documents? You know, because there's a lot of people who say, well, the Bible isn't good enough as a historical document. Of course it's going to say that Jesus rose from the dead. It was written by his followers who want him to be alive. What other sort of historical documentation can we look to sort of corroborate what the scriptures say? Not that that's necessary if you really think of the scriptures as historical documents in of themselves, but, you know, for the skeptics and critics.
You know, a lot of times people say things, but they really don't think about what they're saying.
Yes, that's true.
Now, let's go back to what you just said.
Right.
There are a lot of people out there, say unbelievers, mm-hmm. who say, yeah, all those eyewitnesses were all followers of Jesus. They were all in the circle. You know, they were all colluding together. Listen, here's the problem with that. And by the way, what they're saying when they say that is, we want some eyewitness evidence for the resurrection of Jesus that's impartial. We want some evidence from people who don't believe it. Now, wait a minute. That's impossible. Anytime you're going to have somebody who's going to give testimony that Jesus rose from the dead, that they saw Jesus risen from the dead, is by definition going to be a believer in Jesus' resurrection.
Right.
Which then, therefore, makes him suspect.
Right.
Right? So, you know, you can't have eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus that don't believe in Jesus' resurrection. So therefore, just because we have all these eyewitnesses that write doesn't mean they're all colluding together in this community to secretly perform some kind of hoax. What they're doing is just simply telling what they believed. And they were all willing to die for it, by the way. Most of them actually were taken to their death because they kept insisting that Jesus is risen from the dead. I mean, these were Jews who didn't need a resurrection. They didn't need a resurrected Jesus to keep on being Jews and to keep on being a follower of Jesus.
Right.
I mean, there are plenty of rabbis in the ancient world that people attached themselves to. Jesus could have been just another one of those. But all of a sudden, they were faced with this guy that, here's Jesus. They keep running into him after he's buried, and he's perfectly alive. And after they do this for about 40 days, they finally get it through their head that he's risen from the dead. How are they going to get around that? They couldn't get around it. In fact, they were always going and preaching. If you read the book of Acts, they're always saying to every crowd that they preach to, you can do whatever you want to. You know, you can kill us. You can try to silence us, but we cannot help speaking what we've seen and heard. So, you know, our deaths, torture us, whatever, it's not going to change the facts.
Right. And I always found it kind of interesting that that people have such a hard time with Jesus' resurrection, but you don't hear this much debate about the resurrection of Lazarus. You know, you don't hear people constantly trying to disprove that Lazarus never rose from the dead, and you don't see specials on the Discovery Channel about Lazarus never rose from, you know, I just find it interesting that there's always such a focus on Jesus Christ. Of course, he's the core of Christianity.
Yeah, Lazarus didn't run around claiming to be the Son of God either.
Right, right.
So, you know, if we're going to theologically cut Jesus' feet out from under him, so to speak, you have to attack his claims.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus' claim that he is the divine Son of God, God in the flesh, is completely dependent on his resurrection from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus basically says, kill me, in 3 days I'll rise again. If he doesn't pull that off, then he's not who he claims to be. And Paul picked that up in 1 Corinthians 15. I mean,
Absolutely.
Paul says, if Jesus is not risen from the dead, we are of all men most to be pitied. We're really dumb. Because, you know, Paul's been going through beatings and, you know, beaten within an inch of his life, all kinds of terrible things, terrible problems and suffering because of preaching the resurrection of Jesus. And you could imagine Paul thinking, like, some of these pastors I've been running into recently, they don't believe that Jesus literally physically rose from the dead. And I can't imagine how Paul would react to that. I think he would just say, you guys are crazy.
Yeah.
If Jesus isn't risen from the dead, you know, I'm going to go fishing. I'm going to go, you know, to Disney World for a vacation. I'm not going to waste all my time putting my life on the line for this guy.
505-338-5790. If you got questions about the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, what can we look at to say this was an event that took place in history? So if you'd like to ask about that, it's a good opportunity to ask Dr. Collins what sort of historical evidence is there for the resurrection. 505-338-5790. Now, Dr. Collins, this is something I've often heard, and I've always meant to do the research on and kind of, you know, investigate it for myself, because as with my journalistic nature, you know, I'm always cite your source, and it's something that I've never really been able to follow up on. So now's a good time since you're here in studio. I've often heard it said that there's more historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ than just about any other event in ancient history. That there is more that we can look at to say, yes, this took place in history, than looking at things like the fall of Rome, or, you know, everyone's excited about what the Spartans did, you know, and, you know, currently with the movie 300 out, and, you know, wow, that was a great moment in history. And but there's more evidence for the resurrection. You know, what is your response to a statement like that as an archaeologist? Can you say that there is a lot more evidence for the resurrection than just about any other ancient historical event?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you'd say more than any other, because there are some very well-attested events in antiquity.
Right.
But if you take away the legitimacy, or try to deny the legitimacy of the historical accounts, and I would call them the primary historical accounts. These are primary historical source materials for the life, death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, commonly known as the New Testament Gospels. But that's what they are first and foremost. They are historical eyewitness accounts. If you deny or try to get around what's presented therein, and thereby deny that Jesus rose from the dead, on the same basis, you could get rid of most of what we know of ancient history prior to the Middle Ages.
Really? Wow.
Because the documentary evidence for the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus is so detailed and so clearly from the first half of the first century within the span of the lifetimes of the people who actually witnessed the events in question, that you have to say that you can believe the records or not believe the records, but as records go, as historical records go, those eyewitness historical accounts of Jesus' resurrection are as good as it gets historically, period. We're not talking religion. We're not talking anything like that. We're just talking factual history. How do we establish anything in the past as having occurred? We do it on the basis of eyewitnesses. And you know, you can check their credibility. You have credible eyewitnesses, people who observed events and lived at times when, you know, today it would be easier to pull the wool over people's eyes with, you know, digital technology,
Photoshop.
Yeah, it would be much easier today to perpetrate a hoax than it would have been in antiquity. Because here you have two extremely hostile communities of people against the Christian message. The Jewish community of the first century, mainly the Sanhedrin community, and the Romans themselves. And the eyewitnesses, or as historians we might see, the alleged eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus, took that message straight into the teeth of the opposition and challenged them straight up to try to defy historical facts. There are no first century Christian Jewish writings. There are no first century Roman writings that in any way contradict or overturn the testimony of the eyewitnesses that Jesus had risen from the dead. And by the way, those were powerfully writing communities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were extremely literate. They were always writing polemics against everybody. And had they been able to overturn the story that Jesus had risen from the dead, they would have done it. And by the way, they tried. They were even the Gospel of Matthew says that the Romans had concocted, or the Jews had concocted a story that the Roman centurions fell asleep and that the disciples came and stole the body.
Right.
So I mean, those stories were around even in the time of Jesus. But yet they couldn't hold. Now, it's interesting. Why couldn't anybody write any kind of a polemic against the resurrection of Jesus from the dead in the first century? Well, Paul gives us an indication of why. In 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about the resurrection witnesses, and he mentions a group of over 500 resurrection witnesses, who were most of whom were still alive at the time he wrote that book in about 55. So there you go. You have hundreds of eyewitnesses. And by the way, that's just one group. How many witnesses total were there to the resurrection of Jesus? I think it was such a pervasively common knowledge that nobody was going to stand up in any venue or write something and put their name on it against the resurrection of Jesus in public, because there were too many people to attest to the fact. When you have that many eyewitnesses to attest to a fact in the community of Jerusalem, in and around the whole of Judea and Samaria and so on, then there was no way they were going to overturn that. It didn't. And by the way, factually, historically, it didn't happen, which attests to the power and the multiplicity of the kinds of witnesses to the resurrection that existed in the first century.
That's fascinating. I never thought of it that way. And now, as an archaeologist, as you're going through the gospel accounts of the resurrection, you know, kind of like forensically, or what sort of clues do you see in those accounts that stand out to you as being very factual, that you know, obviously weren't made up, that can lend credence to this whole story, you know, as the world would see it, of the resurrection? You know, some people point out about the fact that there was a seal put on the tomb and how important that was, or, you know, that story of the guards falling asleep and how ludicrous that would be if you knew anything about the time period. As you go through that, point out a few things that always stand out to you as being, you know, that's very historical. That's not something that someone just makes up. That isn't a detail that points to its veracity.
Yeah. In fact, I always challenge people, go back and read the accounts of the resurrection. What you find in all the Gospels is that the accounts are what I call understated. They are matter of fact. They are simply straightforward accounts of physical encounters with a guy who a few days before had been brutally executed by the Romans, gone through an initial sort of embalming sequence with his Jewish followers, put into a tomb, quite dead, and 3 days later comes out. Now, what we find in those eyewitness accounts then are some information that hoaxers, people trying to make up a story, would never have included. Mm-hmm. Or people writing a theological account. A lot of people accuse the Gospel of John of being a theological gospel. It's really not factual. It's more theological. The problem with that is even John's gospel includes little minute details that someone who's trying to pull the wool over our eyes would never even think to write. For example, they go into the tomb and they see how the burial cloth is laid out on the primary burial slab in the tomb, which, by the way, is an accurate depiction of a Judean tomb. So we know that even though Jesus' followers were mostly poor, they actually had an experience of putting Jesus into one of these elaborate tombs. We know that fits the description of these tombs. They put him there, and when they came back to get him, he wasn't there. But the cloth was folded neatly. You know, I guess Jesus didn't want to leave a mess and folds everything up, lays it there. And why in the world would somebody write that? It has no meaning historically. It has no meaning to the story itself. It has no significance other than the fact that whoever the disciple was that stuck his head into that tomb and noticed that and that reported that just thought it was weird. He just thought it was a little, you know, maybe he was a clean freak. Maybe his mother was a clean freak. You know, she always made him make his bed and everything. And he noticed that, oh, you know, it was all kind of neat and fixed. That's a strange thing to say. There are other little things. That thing where Mary Magdalene comes to the garden, back to the garden where the tomb is, and she bumps into Jesus and she thinks he's the gardener. Who would make up this story? This is it's really a sweet little vignette that has no significance whatsoever. It isn't the least bit theological. It has no theological point. It's just that Mary Magdalene bumps into Jesus headlong. She thinks he's the gardener. She's upset. She's weeping. And then Jesus speaks to her. She recognizes his voice. All of a sudden, she realizes, whoa, this is the master. And if you follow her life, of course, Jesus has done great things for her. And she's also been right there at the cross. I mean, she's right there, brutal, seeing all the brutality inflicted on Jesus. And so she's seen this whole execution thing on and all of its steps up close and personal. And now Jesus is standing in front of her in perfect glowing health. I mean, I suppose all clean and neat, you know, not sort of dry cleaned and, you know, all ready to go. And she sees him and she just freaks. She just goes crazy. And you can imagine what you would do. I mean, you know, if 3 days after my grandfather's funeral, I'd seen him, if he walked into my office and saw me doing this, you know, sitting at my table, and he said to me, "Stephen, what would be my reaction?
I'd pass out.
I kind of look at him for a minute, and then I'd probably dive over my desk, and I'd grab him, and I'd shake him, and I'd sort of see if the whole thing was real. That's what she did. I mean, she just went crazy on Jesus. She just jumped on him. She puts her arms, I always think of her putting her arms around his neck and her feet around his waist, and in the most unladylike fashion, and just kind of shaking his head and beating on him. And he says, "Mary, stop clinging to me, you know. Just, you know, go run along now. Go tell the disciples, you know." Now, who would write that? Who would make this up? Not only that, women were not considered to be credible witnesses by the Jewish or Roman community. I mean, in a court of law, you wouldn't call a woman as a witness to attest to something. Now, this is interesting that the primary witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus recorded in the Gospels are the women. The women go and report to the disciples. Now, what was their response?
Nah.
Yeah, you guys, come on.
Get
out of
here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a typical Jewish or Roman male response to women coming and reporting something like Jesus rose from the dead. But yet the gospel writers included the women witnesses as the primary experiencers of Jesus, of the resurrected Jesus. And they don't cut them out because it was factual. It's just true. So the fact that the women witnesses are included, I mean, is a terribly important detail in authenticating the testimony of the eyewitnesses.
Now, as you pointed out earlier in the program, and something I'm sure a lot of people are aware of, every Easter there's these stories about we found Jesus's body. And, you know, this year it was that Discovery Channel special about the lost, quote-unquote, lost tomb of Jesus Christ that James Cameron documented. And I thought that was kind of interesting because it was a discovery that was made mid-1980s or something before, and now they're bringing it back as like another new discovery. And it wasn't all that long ago when they were talking about this new discovery. What is your response to something like that? When something like that comes up, the lost tomb of Jesus Christ, It causes some Christians to freak out. Oh, no, I think they found Jesus' tomb and his bones are there. What are we going to do? What is your response as a Christian and as an archaeologist when something like that happens?
Well, you know, I'm always interested. I mean, anytime you find a tomb with the name, you know, Jesus, son of Joseph, Mary Amne, that they in the documentary said was Mary Magdalene, Yehuda, son of Jesus, and so on and so on and so on. How do you respond? Of course, you have to check things out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't ignore stuff like that. But the problem is that the documentary filmmakers and those involved in telling that story over and over again have completely ignored what all the facts are in the case. The facts are that this isn't the only tomb discovered with an ossuary. That's a limestone bone box with an ossuary with Jesus, son of Joseph, on it. It's not the first one, and it probably won't be the last. So how many Jesuses have we got out there whose fathers are named Joseph?
Quite a few. It was a common name, right?
Yeah, all those names are very common. But there's so many things wrong with that. It would take us so long to deal with that. The thing about it is James Cameron is the one who made the film Titanic.
Right.
He knows nothing about archaeology or how history is done, as far as I can tell. Semka Yakubovich, who was the actual documentary filmmaker. Now, Cameron just bankrolled it. Semka actually is the one who made the documentary, and he makes some pretty good documentaries. Don't ever believe much of it, but he put some things together that are pretty impressive visually. And but the scholar behind it all is James Tabor. Go back and read James Tabor's book. I don't want to get accused of trying to sell James Tabor's book here. James Tabor's a good friend of mine. When he wrote his book, The Jesus Dynasty, he sent me a copy of it pre-publication, and he wrote a little note in there. He said, "Dear Steve," he said, "I really hope you still like me after you read this." Now, in that, you know, he went back and dredged up all the old theories about Mary getting raped by a Roman soldier, and, you know, Jesus, the Roman soldier's named Panteras, and Jesus then is, kind of this father, you know, Panteras runs off, and he's sort of this fatherless kid, and Joseph takes Mary in, and the whole story is that, as the New Testament plays it out, goes on from there. But, you know, so he'd already been spinning those kinds of stories, and he had already talked about that tomb in his book. It had also been talked of. There was a documentary that the British Broadcasting Company, the BBC, did in 1996 on the same tomb, the same ossuaries. They were discovered way back in 1980, and archaeologists didn't really think much about it. But James Tabor, who is a good friend of mine, who's not a Christian, and by the way, he used to be.
Hmm.
Yeah, he started out as a Christian, and then got into archaeology history and kind of departed from the faith, which is too bad. I'm working overtime now on James, but he just got to the point where, you know, if you don't take the New Testament gospel seriously as history, you can do about whatever you want.
Mm.
And that's what he did. And so he was in that documentary. I mean, every time they were looking over a DNA test, or every time they were looking at the patina tests on the ossuaries, there's James Tabor looking over their shoulder, and he's responding. What are we to make of all of this? Listen, there isn't a... I can say this unequivocally, factually, there isn't a single Jewish scholar, agnostic scholar, atheist, there isn't any scholar out there of note who buys this identification as the tomb of Jesus.
Hmm.
There just isn't. And the only people who have suggested it are the people in the documentary. Nobody else will touch it. Even people like Jody Magnus, the great, terrific Jewish scholar, Duke University, says, no way, no way. And everybody else is saying the same thing. It's just nonsense. And there's so much to it that that needs to be brought out that we just don't have time to deal with. But I will just simply say this. The documentary is very selective, and a lot of sleight of hand is going on, and there is a huge amount of material, a huge number of facts that they do not tell you. What they don't tell you will, in fact, and does, in fact, completely destroy their case.
Now, this brings up an interesting point that I wanted to ask you as you move through, you know, the realm of scholars and archaeologists and scientists and historians. And when it comes to this idea of the historical evidence for the resurrection as an actual event in history, what is often the response to this evidence from, you know, other historians and archaeologists and whatnot who don't take the Bible face value? I mean, how do they come to terms with the evidence for the resurrection?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there are a lot of scholars out there who have studied the Gospels, who read all this material, who know it well, but yet they don't believe. Now, how do we account for that? Here's what I find. I just have to be honest about this. And if anybody out there in the category that we just described,
right,
doesn't like what I say, then show me something else. You know, show me another way that you think. But this is the way they think. And I always call these people sort of the liberal Christians or the liberal scholars, liberal biblical critics, however you want to style them.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to remain a liberal biblical critic that doesn't believe that Jesus rose from the dead in spite of the gospel evidence, you have to split your world in two, and you can never let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And here's why. Because to get rid of the resurrection, here's what they always say. That the stories of the miracles, particularly the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, are late myths and legends that grew up far after the events themselves,
mm-hmm.
or the alleged events. Late in the first century, maybe even into the second century, stories made up by non-eyewitnesses. And then they deny that any of the Gospels, they will say none of the Gospels was written by an eyewitness or had any contact with eyewitnesses. And they will just say these, they will pontificate these things. They will just throw that out there and say, this is a fact. But here's the other side. Now, that's on one hand. On one hand, they'll just straight up deny the early eyewitness nature of these accounts. On the other hand, they will also agree, and they have to agree, for example, that 1 Corinthians was written in about 55 by Paul, who then says in 1 Corinthians 15 that I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. Paul says, I'm going to give to you what I received. Now, when did Paul receive that? Everybody agrees, all scholars agree, that Paul received this message when he became a Christian. When did Paul become a Christian? 3 or 4 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. So sometime around AD 35, 36. Now, watch this. Here's the sleight of hand. Here's what they do, not letting the left hand know what the right hand is doing. All scholars will attest that what Paul says from that point in 1 Corinthians 15 is the earliest formal, systematic gospel proclamation recorded in history. This is the gospel as it appeared in the early Christian community, just the infant Christian community in 35, 36. And here's what Paul says. I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen by, and then he lists a whole bunch of the eyewitnesses. Now, there it is. The life, the death, the burial, and resurrection of Jesus, all summed up in almost a little poetic, liturgical kind of mnemonic ditty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there it is. And everybody dates that, on the one hand, to the mid-30s. But then the liberal, on the other hand, will say, oh, the resurrection of Jesus is a theological myth perpetrated by the early Christian community sometime late in the first century. Whoa, 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 you can't have your cake and eat it too. On the one hand, we say it's late. On the other hand, we all agree that in Paul we have the preservation of the resurrection story going right back to the mid-30s. Now, they never, and by the way, if you hit a liberal up with that, they just turn red. Because factually, they can't deal with it. Because it's, they know that they hold both of those things to be true. And so, they, if you force them to think about those in the same room at the same time on the same day, they just don't know what to do with it. The fact of the matter is that you either historically, as an evidential factualist, if you would like to consider yourself such, say, I just believe what I can put my hands on, the evidence I can see. Listen, if that's the kind of person you are, then you will come to the conclusion that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Or be fair to yourself and throw out everything you ever thought about history prior to the Middle Ages. Don't study Greece, don't study Rome, don't study Plato, don't study Aristotle. Throw out all of that because
the rest, 300.
Because the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus has more historical and more solid eyewitness historical attestation than all of that stuff.
Now, at the beginning of the program, we asked the question, does it matter if the resurrection was a historical event? So, you know, we got about 10 minutes here left. How would you answer that question? As an archaeologist, as a Christian, as a professor who teaches, you know, things of history, does it matter if this was a historical event? Is there any harm for Christians to just believe a quote-unquote myth, a story that was concocted about Jesus rising from the dead? Because that brings hope and, you know, things like that. Or does it really matter that it was an event of history?
Yeah, because half of Christians... Now, over half the pastors in, say, traditional mainline denominational churches don't believe Jesus physically rose from the dead. And something on that order probably would go for the rest of Christianity in general.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people, but it doesn't mean they don't believe in a resurrection. They just make it spiritual. Jesus had, it was a spiritual resurrection. The disciples and others had a vision of Jesus. You know, he may have still been in the tomb, but they had a vision that he was risen from the dead. There's a serious problem with that. Number one, if that were the case, then the eyewitness writers would have said it. They didn't need to invent a physical resurrection from the dead. But yet, every single word that describes the resurrection in the historical accounts is of a purely physical resurrection. Jesus says to Thomas, here, Thomas, give me your hand. Grabs it, sticks it into his side so he can feel it. You know, this is really me.
He even ate food to prove
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, he eats and he hangs out with everybody. I mean, he's doing more than... I mean, the appearances that we see in the Gospels are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, he's hanging out with these people for 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see him in the most intimate kinds of situations, and he's really alive. Well, if that isn't true, then they have cooked up a pretty hefty hoax here. And they not only fooled a lot of other people, they must have succeeded in fooling themselves because they were all killed for it. All this doesn't make sense, but let's get back to the question. Does it really matter? I mean, why can't we just have kind of a spiritual resurrection? Why do we need a physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead? Number one, because if you don't believe in a physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead, then you just have to let go everything we know of in the Gospels. I mean, you just have to let it go because that's part of the story. I mean, either believe it or it's a historical account or it isn't a historical account. Everything about the physical resurrection. And by the way, Paul says this. We're going to be resurrected in exactly the same way that Jesus was resurrected. And people don't understand what is salvation anyway? Salvation is not the escape of the spirit from the body going up into, you know, nirvana somewhere. Salvation, New Testament salvation, is the physical resurrection of everybody, every believer from the dead. Jesus is the first fruits. We're the second fruits.
Right.
We're coming along after. That is New Testament salvation. I mean, if it's not, then what is the whole Christian message? We're going to live forever in our physical resurrected bodies.
Which I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be absolutely great. And I still don't understand, you know, why would you call yourself a Christian if you don't believe in the resurrection of the namesake of the faith that you proclaim to have?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you might even say that Christianity is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. I mean, that's what it is. That's what sets it apart from Judaism. That's what sets it apart from everything else in the world, is not only the claim that Jesus is the incarnate Son of God, God in the flesh, but that he brings a calling card with him. And his calling card is his physical resurrection from the dead. Here's what demonstrates it. And without that, you know, Jesus is just another
dude.
Just another spiritual avatar. You know, he's just another rabbi. He's just another good teacher. And Jesus just doesn't allow us that.
Now, I just thought of something else I wanted to ask, and I wish I would have thought of this earlier, but it's something that comes up a lot when you talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Every culture has a myth of some deity figure rising from the dead, and Christianity's deity figure rising from the dead is just another one of those. It's just another part of those types of myths and whatnot. You know, like there's Greek legends of gods coming back to life. There's, you know, Native American legends of gods coming back to life. This is a very common theme. Of course, Christianity has to have one because every culture has had one. How do you respond to that kind of criticism that it's a common part of cultural myth?
Yeah, and being born of a god, you know. I mean, you know, we could put all that stuff in the same category.
Right.
The difference is that what we're dealing with in the New Testament eyewitness historical accounts is a group of physical eyewitnesses to the events in question who have given us these stories as straight up as eyewitness accounts, real things that they experienced, physical things that they describe. The all these other stories are presented as myths and in the fabric of legends, whereas the New Testament Gospels don't give us a mythical or a legendary fabric. It is a completely factual canvas, and everything that's painted on it is a piece of the facts all asserted by eyewitnesses. And that's the difference. We're dealing with something that's purely and completely historical here. And not only that, it's testable, it's checkable. All these other myths and legends about, you know, gods dying and rising from the dead and all of that, which go all the way back to ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of that is, you know, it's not presented as history. This is presented as factual, tangible history. And in fact, it's so good. The reports are so good. The reports, the quality of the witnesses is so good that we just can't get around it. We just can't get around it. And, you know, Jesus is the only guy, historically, who says, okay, you know, I have made some pretty astounding claims. But just to kind of go one up on everybody, kill me, in 3 days, I'll rise again. And, well, he pulls that off. Now, you have to come to some kind of conclusion. What does the resurrection? Jesus is, in fact, historically risen from the dead, physically. Now you have to say, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
What am I going to do? In fact, some Jewish scholars will even say, okay, we admit he rose from the dead, but he's the Messiah for the Gentiles.
Hmm.
We're still looking for a Jewish Messiah.
Wow. That is.
Now, that's been said by several Jewish scholars. That's a, you know, but at least it admits, hey, you know, the historical evidence is what it is.
Right.
And let's leave it alone. Let's let it be.
Man.
And but we still have to ask the question, what does this resurrection mean?
Yeah. Man, I just get all goosebumpy and excited when, you know, I talk about this type of stuff. And I thank you so much for joining us tonight and lending your perspective as a professor and archaeologist and as a fellow Christian to all of this. And it such a treat for me because, you know, we're getting ready to celebrate this resurrection. And just to think that this isn't just some story that you tell in Sunday school. This isn't something just to make you feel good. It's not a reason to get chocolates and paint eggs. This is something that took place in history, and it's going to happen again when he comes to, you know, reclaim his own. And, man, it was so good to talk to you. I mean, I'm really stoked now for, not that I wasn't before, but I'm really excited now for Easter. And what a great time to do it on Palm Sunday as we celebrate his coming to Jerusalem to do all this. I'm very excited. So thank you so much for hanging out with us tonight, Dr. Collins. It's been a special treat for me.
Great to be here, yo.
Man, I'm really stoked. I hope you guys are excited for Easter as well. I want to leave you with John chapter 20, verse 31, that says, "But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." And that's the reason the Gospels were written, for that very purpose. You want to have life? You want to know what Easter is all about? It's about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, him dying for your sins and then coming back to life so that you can have life in his name. And even if you're someone who just goes to church Christmas and Easter, I hope that listening to something like this will remind you that there's more, so much more than just Christmas and Easter. That's just the tip of the surface of what you can experience with Jesus Christ. He's not some myth God that we tell children to, you know, put them to bed at night. He was a actual historical person who walked this earth, and he died, and he rose again, and he walked the earth some more before he ascended into heaven, and he's going to come back, and he's going to walk the earth, the new earth, with us. And if that's something that you would like to experience, if you'd like to get to know this person of history better, ask him into your life. Start reading your Bible. And if you got questions, you can always email us at studio@m88.org. We'd be more than happy to talk to you about this great thing that we all hold to be true, because it is true. You can't deny history. Well, you can, but then you're living in your own little deluded world, and that's really not all that fun. So I hope that you'll take the time this week to review those eyewitness accounts and get excited. People saw Jesus alive, and we're going to get to see that too someday, and that's really exciting. Well, next Sunday is Easter, so I hope you all don't mind, but I'm going to take some time to celebrate Easter with my family, and so we won't be doing a Raw Talk next week live. But the week after that, we'll come back and we'll talk about missions. Here we're talking about the greatest thing that ever took place in history. Well, then we're going to talk about what do we do with it. We got to go tell people. How could you not want to tell people? This is the most exciting thing that ever happened ever in all of history, and we need to tell people about it. And so we're going to discuss how we can do that as we examine missions and who should be going on missions. So we'll be doing that on April 15th. So I hope you come back and join us for that show. Thanks for joining us tonight here on Raw Talk. And I hope you have a great week leading up to the celebration of Jesus' death and resurrection.